and people would be thinking about you and your lordship and about your creation. And we pray for Hugh as he shares today. Amen.
And Rich, I can empathize. I took my sons on a hike too, and two of them didn't come. The difference is I only have two sons. So, but I appreciate too you taking the class in my absence. I've heard many good things about your teaching. So it's wonderful that when I do go on these ministry trips that we got such excellent teachers here in the class to take my place. So appreciate that very much. Well, this was one of those. I did two trips, one to Aspen and one to Washington, D.C., kind of back to back. And I think of all the trips I've done in the past couple of years, these are the trips where I learned more from teaching than I have before. And I think I really came by learning more than the people I taught. I mean, that often happens. You go out to teach and you wind up being taught some very important lessons. So this shot here is Snowmass, which is about 20 miles outside of Aspen, and that's where I met with the Traumatology Society. And these are medical doctors who work on trauma. Although, as I and by the way, this is why they call it Aspen. Let me just show you a few of the. We can take some of the lights down. You'll be able to see this. But beautiful aspens everywhere you look. So. There's a good reason why they call it Aspen. So, but I found out that this traumatology society really wasn't a traumatology society. They were all medical researchers. In other words, they weren't just MDs. They were MDs, PhDs, and very involved in research. And this was a conference they had where they were reporting on their latest research. But they had, orthopedic surgeons, they had urologists, they had oncologists. Basically what they were medical researchers who were all mountaineers. In fact, they had a whole day on high-altitude medicine. And what I discovered is that, whenever they have one of these mountaineering expeditions, a serious expedition, they're required to take a medical doctor with them because of the kinds of things that can happen. And so I was talking to people who had been up K2 and Everest and Annapurna and, all these exotic mountaineering things. So that's what keeps them together. They come together every winter to ski at Aspen and to have a conference. And while they're at the conference, they figure out what expedition they're all going to get involved in for the summer. So, I enjoy the mountains too. I don't do things like they do, but I enjoy mountains too. And so I really felt at home there. And their research was top-notch, just listening to some of the papers that they were presenting. This is the first time that this Traumatology Society had ever sponsored a Christian message. And they just thought, well, they might be something interesting to even think about. And so, but before I addressed them, since I was going to Aspen, a friend of the ministry set me up to address a church in Aspen. And it was United Methodist Church, and he told me it's probably the most liberal church in town. So he says, give it a shot. They might actually listen to the idea that the Bible is the Word of God. And so I decided, well, I've only got an hour with them, although it turned out to be more like 4.5 hours. But it was a breakfast. I spoke for a little less than an hour, and then there was 3.5 hours of Q&A. And one of the reasons why the Q&A went so long is that this event was crashed by the local Baptist church. Now, because they heard I was coming, and they said, we'd like to get involved too. Well, I later found out that these two churches are at the polar extremes in Aspen. One is ultra-conservative, the other is ultra-liberal. So it was a new experience for me to address an audience that were at these polar extremes. And I targeted my message to appeal to what I thought would work for a liberal audience, which is simply to look at the first chapter of the Bible and see how its message is consistent with the latest scientific findings, not only in terms of the details of creation, but in terms of the order, and then use that as a way to show how the 66 books of the Bible likewise are consistent, not only consistent, but reliable in the revelation of truth. And I thought, well, you know, maybe that would be just a good seed to plant, that the Bible really is a trustworthy text after all. Now, what I discovered is that these two audiences had one thing in common. The one thing they had in common was the belief that it's impossible to reconcile the content of Genesis 1 with the scientific record. What the United Methodists did was they threw out the Bible. And what the Baptists did is they threw out the science. And so what I discovered is just what an excellent message this is when you're dealing with an audience where they're both in, where they're both coming from the polar extremes, and also how important it was to let the Q&A go on. Because in the first hour of the Q&A, there was lots of tension and conflict amongst the two groups. But as they kept asking questions, things got resolved, and they're beginning to see a new perspective. And it's hard to get people to change their position in the course of, say, 90 minutes or even 120 minutes. But the wonderful thing was, after 4.5 hours, these two groups were shaking hands and excited about a new paradigm they'd seen on science and the Bible that they'd never seen before. And they're all eager to get on our mailing list, and they were asking me questions, and the books we had, they're sold out. So, and I also found out that Aspen is kind of an intellectual center in our country. I never thought of that. I thought just a place where people go to ski. But the pastor of the United Methodist Church, she drove me down the main street of Aspen and pointed out all the institutes that have an office there. The Institute of Physics has an office there. The American Association of Advancement of Sciences, they got a place there. And then, you know, her husband was a literature professor, so he proudly pointed out all the different art and literature institutes that are there. But what they were encouraging us at Reasons to Believe is, you know, we're going to try to put in a good word for you at these institutes, because just like the traumatologists, were listening to a Christian message for the first time, she thought they would be open. And something I learned there is, you know, when people are on vacation, they're a little more open to consider ideas they've never thought about before than when they're, quote, at work. And, you know, Aspen's a place where people go to have fun, but it's also a place where they go to have their minds be challenged. So, but, you know, don't try to buy a condo or a duplex there. So I saw this run-down half-duplex. It was selling for $4.25 million. However, you managed to get 1,100 square feet of space for that. So, I mean, what a bargain. I thought real estate in Japan was expensive. They got nothing on Aspen. So, you know, they paid my way, so I didn't have to really deal with all that. Although I did at one point. My lunch wasn't covered, and I didn't get much to eat for breakfast, so I was really hungry for lunch, and I was wandering around on the main street of Snowmass, and, you know, lunches were starting at $30 and going up to $50. And, you know, these weren't good lunches either. So I said, you know, I don't have that kind of money in my wallet. What am I going to do? Well, I finally found this outdoor sidewalk sandwich place. It was 4 degrees. So it was cool. And this guy was, you know, he had all his clothes on and so forth, a wrap. And anyway, he was willing to sell me a sandwich for $12.50. So that was my sandwich. Well, it was frozen when it was given to me, but when I got it back to my hotel room, it did thaw out, so that was good. But and the doctors, I wound up giving a message to them. In fact, they told me what they wanted to hear. They had heard that I had been involved in presenting our testable model of creation on university campuses where we had atheist professors give a response. They said, we want that talk. But we also want time to grill you. So I wound up spending literally 4.5 hours with them as well. But that was interesting in the sense that they had really never heard an integration at the scientific level. And just the whole idea of how you can put your beliefs to the test. And I was showing them how they can put atheistic beliefs to the test, agnostic beliefs, theistic beliefs, as well as our model that we've developed at Reasons to Believe. And there was two rather outspoken atheists that were members of the group. And they were the ones that probably changed the most in the course of the evening. They were just so excited and asking questions about this material. And in fact, what they said at the end of this, we got to do this in every meeting. So, wonderful time. And I learned some things about what kinds of messages you should use when you're facing hostile audiences. And, you know, somehow God worked it out so that we had just the right two messages. Because I realized if I'd spoken on something else, it wouldn't have had the same impact. And, you know, there's certain messages that will open doors for dialogue. And the message I used for the morning group wouldn't have worked on the evening group and vice versa. And it was somewhat of an accident. I didn't plan this because I really didn't know what the groups were like. And so by accident... not by accident, and God was behind it, we had just the precise message that each of those two different groups needed. And the other thing is that the traumatologists were really excited about getting not just me back, but other members of our Reasons to Believe team. And of course, when I told that to the other members of our team, they said, Aspen, we're ready to go. So, wasn't hard to talk to them about it at all. So, yeah, this was the message I gave to the morning group, and then to the doctors. And of course, what worked well with these doctors or mountaineers is I loaded up my message with all kinds of beautiful mountain shots. And again, I didn't plan that. I didn't know that they were mountaineering types. So, and what also helped is I explained to the group they were, especially the atheists in the group. You could tell they were really angry at young Earth creationists and really angry at the intelligent design movement. And so I started off by saying, I'm going to give this talk exactly like I do on a university campus. So the first thing I have to do in a university campus is tell the audience what I am not. And so I actually told them what I was not, and that was really crucial for that group. I wasn't aware of the degree to which they were so disturbed about the young Earth creationism and the intelligent design movement, and how, you know, we're different. We have a full-orbed and consistent and integrated creation model that is falsifiable and also predictive, able to make predictions for future scientific discoveries. Well, I flew home. I was home for a little more than a day, then had to fly out to Washington, D.C., and our entire scholar team went out to Washington, D.C. We had over 17 events in the D.C. area, and you know, I would recommend that you take a little more than a day between two trips like that, because what happened during that day is my son came home from his semester that he had finished at Academy of Arts University in San Francisco, and he was coming home because his court case is coming up. If you don't know, he was stabbed last Christmas, and the people who stabbed him are now coming up for court, and he's a survivor. His friend was killed, but he survived. So he's going to have to testify, and they've asked him if he could please be available for the next semester. So he's going to be spending the next semester at home. But he had to bring home all of his art stuff. And, you know, we went up to San Francisco to visit him, and you know, he loves doing these big canvases. Well, he brought all this stuff home. I don't know where we're going to put it all. But the other thing is he said, Dad, I got to rent a truck. So he rented a one-way truck and drove home. And then he arrived home late the night before I had to go to D.C. I had a morning flight the next day. And he says, well, Dad, my friends are getting married, and I'm going to be part of this wedding party. And he said, can you take care of returning the truck? And he says, oh, by the way, I got a parking ticket too. Can you take care of that? So the next morning, I had to take care of his parking ticket, and I had to return the truck, and I had to get to the LAX airport. So I was a little bit stressed by the time I got to LAX, wondering whether I was going to get on the plane, running through the airport. And I got up to the top of the escalator, grabbed my bags. Anyway, I really tweaked my back.
Oh.
Worst I've ever done in my life. And so I went up to the United thing, and I says, you know, how full is the plane? She says, it's packed. And I says, well, I won't be able to fly on that plane. And I says, you know, I can't sit. And she looked at me and says, yeah, I can tell you can't sit. So, but they got me on. It says, you know, do you have any checked bags? I says, no. It says, well, we got a flight leaving right now, and it's only 50% full. So I jumped on that flight and wound up. Well, they forced me to sit when they were taking off, and that was just excruciating. But, you know, they knew about my back condition, so they put off the seatbelt lights as quickly as possible. And so I got up. But it took me, oh, probably 8 or 10 minutes just to go from a sitting position to a standing position. Anyway, the guy across the aisle from me, he looked at me and said, this trip has got to be really important for you. He says, what are you doing in D.C.? So I told him what I was going to be doing in D.C., and he says, oh, that's so interesting. He says, I'm a physics grad from Stanford, and you know, you got a couple of degrees there in physics. And he said, my favorite physics professor at Stanford, and he couldn't remember the guy's name, but he said, he was a fellow who wrote a book on Christianity and science. And he says, you know, he was about 35 years of age, this person. And he says, I've always thought, you know, sometime in my life, I need to really give some thought to these things. And he says, meeting you has told me I really need to start doing it, need to start doing it now. So he wound up talking along the whole flight. You know, it was a little more than a four-hour flight. And so we had a great conversation. And, you know, he's got our website, so he's going to go to the website and says, you know, I realize, you know, I really need to really start checking this stuff out. But here is this professor who is an example to his class. And, you know, here it was 15 years later where it actually bears some fruit. So you never know what can happen. Anyway, this is Washington, D.C., and I was not the first to get there because I was Fuzz and Jeff Swearink. Fuzz Ron and Jeff Swearink got there a day before I did. And what they did is they went to Morgan State University. And Morgan State is in the inner city of Baltimore. It was founded as a black university. It's still probably 95% black, and that's not just the student body, that's also the faculty. It was founded as a Christian college. It's now a state university. But the state has allowed the university to maintain their faith initiatives. And so they're very involved with churches. Churches work with the university to help disadvantaged students get accepted there at Morgan State, and the churches continue to work with the students as they get through their undergraduate and graduate education. A lot of the professors there are not just professors, they're also reverends. And Fuzz and Jeff got to meet a bishop there, and the bishop, turns out he's on our mailing list, very excited about Fuzz and Jeff coming there. And basically took them out to lunch afterwards and says, we want to start a Reasons to Believe chapter right on this campus. Says, not only that, we want to use your guys to go into the inner city. And he already done some research on us. He discovered, for example, that I was raised in the slums of Vancouver, and that Fuzz and Ken Samples, our philosopher, were raised in rural West Virginia. And they said, you know, that's really important, because the people in the inner city really don't want to listen to rich white people. They will listen to white people, but they want to make sure that they're people that understand their culture and their situation. But basically told us the door is wide open. Moreover, he said, I'm going to give you a list of black universities throughout the country. It turns out there's many of them throughout the country that are just like Morgan State. They're in the inner city. They're committed not only to educate, but to minister to the inner city. And they integrate with the people in the inner city, and especially the churches. And because they're reaching out to the black community, the state doesn't interfere with the faith initiatives. I mean, one thing about inner city blacks, almost all of them believe in God. And for all of them, they all have at least a grandmother who's very committed to the Christian faith. And therefore, the state has saw fit not to interfere with these faith initiatives. The other thing that this bishop pointed out to us is, you guys will not have to worry about theistic evolution or young earth creationism or the intelligent design movement. They're not here. So basically what you're dealing with the inner city black community is they've not been touched by apologetics at all, but they're hungry for it. And I've seen that myself here in L.A. When you go into the inner city churches of L.A., it's clear that they've never been exposed to this stuff and they're starved for it. And so we've made a decision to really make this a priority for our ministry. And wonderful thing is, we won't have the normal resistance that we have on other campuses or in other churches. So we look at this as a really exciting opportunity for the organization. And then Fuzz and Jeff went to John Hopkins University. Opposite extreme. John Hopkins ministers to very wealthy white folks and Asians. That's their target audience. It's one of the top universities in the country, has only 4,000 students. But Caltech has only 1,400, so it's a lot like Caltech. Strong on the sciences, particularly strong in medicine. But when Jeff and Fuzz spoke there, they drew 10% of the student body. So quite good in the context that we've never been on that campus before. But they did their testable creation model where they had professors who were not Christians give a response. And the John Hopkins faculty basically said, we've never done this before. We need to do it again. So, and you know, you can imagine Jeff and Fuzz just came out of that experience on cloud nine, being at these two different campuses, very different campuses, and seeing God work in that way. So when I got there, I spoke at George Mason University. The D.C. area is filled with these different universities. So we were on actually four different university campuses while we were there. George Mason University, you can describe as being, oh, something in between Morgan State and John Hopkins, in between in terms of its academic excellence, in between to and to whom they appeal, and it's also not that expensive of a place to go. I heard that John Hopkins ranks as the fourth most expensive university you can possibly attend. Actually beats out USC, if you can believe that, in terms of tuition you have to pay. But George Mason wasn't in that category. And I would say George Mason is probably the most multicultural university in the D.C. area. I mean, the audience I addressed, you had people from all different countries and all different ethnic backgrounds. And they had me speak in what was called the Bistro. And what that is a lecture hall right next to the diner cafeteria. And all around the lecture hall are booths where people have their meals. And the interesting thing about that is the people who really want to attend the lecture, they fill up the lecture hall area about all the chairs that are there. And people who weren't planning to go to lecture at all but just have dinner, they wind up getting involved as well. So we pulled a lot of extra people in who were simply there just to have some food. And that was interesting because the people there for food wound up getting really involved in the Q&A time. So, and the message I spoke on there was why the universe is the way it is. And I'm finding that that's a really good message when you're dealing with intellectuals who come from a variety of different perspectives. Because the audience I addressed, there were atheists in the audience, there were young earth creationists in the audience, theistic evolutionists, intelligent design proponents, but nobody who took our position. So And part of the dynamics was trying to answer the questions in such a way that fights wouldn't break out in the audience from people who disagreed with one another.
Maybe you could get minority funding from the government.
I might be able to get some minority funding from the government, true. But you know, Why the Universe is the Way It is a lecture that really gives people the big picture on creation. And in that sense, administered to all these different disparate groups. And particularly with the idea that there's two creations, not one. And that this creation we're in, the universe, the physical universe, serves the primary purpose of being a vehicle to bring about the end of all evil. Well, what that did is it motivated these four different groups to really think about things in terms of creation they never thought about before. So again, it's a great way to try to make some peace. And then the other campus that we were on, I wasn't on this one, but International University. And this is a university that's really targeting the children of all the diplomats that are in the D.C. area. So hardly anybody at the International University, with the exception of the faculty, are American citizens. Almost all of them are either expatriates or the children or their relatives of the diplomatic community that is there. And so Fuzz and Ken Samples were there speaking on that campus. And that was interesting because there you're dealing with Muslims and Hindus and Buddhists, and likewise they discovered that it's really critical that you have a message that's developed that's able to simultaneously minister to all those different groups. But my primary role as part of the Reasons to Believe team was to target the churches that had rejected us in the past. And what we've learned about the D.C. area is that almost all of the churches are strongly young earth in their perspective. And in the past, they were adamant in saying, no way are we going to let Reasons to Believe come in to speak. Well, our chapter there, we have a very dynamic chapter in Washington, D.C., somewhere between, I would met over 50 people that were part of that chapter. And they were the ones, I mean, believe it or not, we were there for a different purpose. I'll tell you about that in a moment. And we said, look, we're coming to D.C. We're going to be there in 60 days' time. What can you pull together? Well, they pulled all these different events together. I mean, that chapter is really to be commended with what they were able to do in just 60 days' time. But the chapter was especially interested in being able to penetrate the church community. They said it's one thing to get into the universities and the different research labs that exist in the D.C. area, but you know, if we're successful in bringing people to Christ in that arena, you know, how are we going to get them into the church if indeed the churches are committed to this young earth creationist position? So what they did to appeal to the churches and say, well, look, we know you're committed to the young earth position, but, you know, it's critical that the young earth community be able to understand the alternate views. So how about if you bring Dr. Ross in? He has a reputation for not being offensive on these issues. Just, you know, you can ask him any question you want, but at least you can hear what that perspective is all about. And so the church has actually agreed to have me in under controlled conditions. And, you know, they put different kinds of controls on it. But what I actually did is that I'm not going to speak on the young earth, old earth issue. I'm going to speak on something I think they need to hear about that's got nothing to do with the young earth, old earth issue, and figure out that the Q&A time will be the time we can actually address these different issues. And so I spoke first to the C.S. Lewis Institute. And that's an institute that's targeting the intellectual community. But they've been strongly young earth in their perspective and consequently have turned off a lot of the intellectuals in the D.C. area. Anyway, they agreed to have me give two back-to-back lectures. And I said, well, you know, I typically don't do that. It's a little bit hard on the audience to give an hour-long lecture, have an hour of Q&A, another hour-long lecture, another hour of Q&A. I said, this is D.C., Washington, D.C., you know, I've now discovered that there's actually intelligent life in Washington. So you wouldn't believe it by some of the politics that goes on, but no, D.C. really is. I mean, they pride themselves on being the intellectual center of the country. and what they were just saying at the C.S. Lewis Institute, we're used to having hours and hours of intellectual content. He says that's why people come to the C.S. Lewis Institute. And so they said, we want you to give your personal testimony, but do it in such a way where you show how it integrates with the Bible and science. And so that works easily because, you know, my testimony is one of actually going through the Bible to see if it had any scientific accuracy. And so I targeted Genesis chapter 1. I figured that worked in Aspen. Maybe it will work here in Washington, D.C. And so I came off with this thing about an astronomer's quest. And I talked about how I was raised in British Columbia. Here's a little shot of British Columbia that I showed them. It actually looks like that in the wild. That's not a planted garden. That's really the way it looks. So, but they really began to listen when they recognized I hadn't met a Christian to talk about anything spiritually significant until I was 27 years of age. And the people there at the C.S. Lewis Institute, they're interested in reaching out to people of other cultures that have not been exposed to the Christian faith. So that immediately gave me some credibility with them. And I kind of went through my analysis of Genesis 1, not even touching on the young earth, old earth issue, but of course the questions came up at the end. And what I discovered, in fact what was interesting, is the president of the C.S. Lewis Institute gave about a 15-minute disclaimer before he introduced me. I said, this is interesting. I'm going to be here for 4 hours minimum, and yet he's taking another 15 minutes. But what he was doing is explaining, you know, we have some theistic evolutionists here at the C.S. Lewis Institute, but most of us here are young earth in our perspective. And, you know, but we believe that it's important to be educated in all perspectives. That's why we've invited Dr. Ross. So that was kind of the disclaimer he gave. But what I learned is that the young earth community, you know, I've known this for some time, but wasn't aware to the degree this is happening, especially in the D.C. area, have told people in the churches that I'm very mean-spirited, very combative, you know, saying all the, I mean, I'm some kind of monster. So,
an evil twin out there.
Right. So, what surprised the congregation is I didn't fit the monster profile that they had heard. So, maybe to some degree, but not like they had been told. That immediately opened up things, and then I wound up following that up with why the universe is the way it is, the big picture. And of course, what I've always believed about young earth creationism is that I'm not nearly so concerned about their perspective on the age of the earth as I am. Is that my phone that's going off like that? It's not yours, it's probably mine. Let me take care of that so it doesn't bother all of you.
Your son wants the truck back.
Yeah. Dad, I need my rent money or something. So I can just turn that off here. There we go. Sorry about that. But yeah, in young earth creationism, they have this belief that there's only one creation and God's going to restore us to paradise. And so giving us why the universe is the way it is, big picture on creation, two creation model, anyway, it really struck a positive chord. And the audience really warmed up to me after that second talk. The first talk kind of opened up a door. The second talk really made a difference. The president came up to me afterwards. I kind of started off with Stephen Hawking. I found out they're all fans of Stephen Hawking. So that was really good that I used that and just made the point that Hawking here speaks for all of us, that we all want to know why the universe is the way it is, what is our place in it, and where did it and we come from. Well, I talked to the president afterwards, and he said, you know, this is the first time the C.S. Lewis Institute has sponsored a talk that it was science-based. And I said, well, that's kind of unusual. C.S. Lewis was really interested in these things. But he said, yeah, we've targeted literature, we've targeted music, we've targeted the arts. And after all, C.S. Lewis is most famous for being a literary scholar. So that makes sense. But he says, you know, this thing about science is really interesting. The other thing they noticed is they had to set up 100 extra seats. So he says, we drew more people than we ever had before. And he says, this is something we need to do more often. And told me that he thought the two talks I had were especially appealing, again, to the disparate audiences. And he wound up telling me that it was the most inspirational talk he'd ever heard. So, but I figured, hey, if that works on him, it's going to work on other people. So the next day, I spoke in a church. And in that church, I was told there was going to be a lot of children and youth. And so what I did is I gave this talk on Beyond the Cosmos and the Transdimensionality of God. And this is where I don't use any kind of fancy keynote like this. I have a table, and I do tabletop demonstrations. What life is like in two dimensions, three dimensions, four dimensions, 10 dimensions, then get into God's transdimensionality. And also made the comment that this is a message that typically is more easily understood by 4- and 5-year-olds than people who are in their 40s, 50s, and 60s. Well, what was interesting is we actually had a little Q&A time. It was a sermon, a Sunday morning sermon, but it really was demonstrated to the congregation. The kids really got it. And in fact, one kid was explaining to his parents what I was saying. So it worked really well, yes. They were taped. We should be able to get the messages.
I'd love to hear that.
Well, if you want to hear that one, I think we have it on the table there. It's called Beyond the Cosmos. It's a DVD that I did up in San Francisco in front of an audience of about 20 people. Not necessarily kids, but it's actually, because in this message I only had 30 minutes. You know, it's typical of a church Sunday morning service. You only get a limited amount of time. The DVD there is a 45-minute message, so you actually get a little more content on the DVD that's over there in the table. Yeah, the demonstrations are in the DVD. In fact, it's better because they had three cameras, so they're able to get one camera up on a high pedestal and look down on my table, as well as some from the side. They did a really good job. Anyway, it's over there, and I think we're selling it for only $5, so what a bargain. Okay. Anyway, this is King's Chapel, solid younger church, and this message had nothing to do with those kinds of issues, but they really liked the demo. They loved the fact that the kids got so involved, and basically they said afterwards, the pastor said, anytime a reasonably scholar is in town, we want them. And says, you can speak on anything you want. So again, it really opened up a door. And the evening, I spoke at New Hope Church. Again, another solid younger church, but based on my experience, I said, I'm going to speak on why the universe is the way it is. And again, it was a talk that really opened up a lot of doors. And I got the same comment from the pastor. Any time a reasonably scholar is in town, we want them to address. And I said, well, how about the chapter leaders? Because this is in the chapter. We have a top-notch PhD scholar at Johns Hopkins. He's very good at giving lectures. And he says, we have medical people that are outstanding in giving. And he says, fine, bring them in. We want them. Yes.
Do you have that lecture here anywhere that we can get yet? Or are you going to make one for us? Or?
Well, there is the book, which is over the table, and we do have a DVD of it somewhere. Bob, I'm trying to remember if we got it for sale yet or not.
I don't think it's for sale yet.
Okay, we have a DVD that we've recorded, but I don't think it's packaged for sale yet. So, okay, we'll let you know when it is. But, you know, that was just kind of the extras. Our primary reason for going to Washington, D.C., was to dialogue with the Biologos organization. So it was a dialogue between Reasons to Believe and Biologos. Biologos is probably the most prominent theistic evolution organization in the country today. And, you know, they agreed to... We've had several dialogues with them, but this is one where we were all face-to-face. Previous dialogues, we had maybe one person face-to-face with us and the others on the phone, but this time we were all face-to-face. So, of course, from our perspective, you have the day-age creationists, and with Biologos, you had the theistic evolutionists. And I can give you the names from the people on our side. They were Lynn Carta, and Lynn used to be a member of this class, Lynn and her husband, David. Both of them have PhDs. And Lynn's PhD is in biology. She was at Caltech, and she got hired away from Caltech to head up our nation's largest evolutionary biology lab in between Baltimore and D.C. And so she joined us, and then we had Fuzz Rana, our staff alchemist, myself, and Ken Samples, our staff theologian. And on the other side, they had three biologists and one theologian. And by the way, we're going to be printing an official report of the meeting. And so I'm going to ask you not to quote anything I'm sharing with you, but you're going to be free to quote from the written statement. The written statement's going to be circulated amongst all 8 of the participants, and we'll be making that available both on our website and on their website. So I do ask you, you know, don't repeat anything I've said here. We all want to make sure that everybody is quoting from the same statement. Anyway, that'll be ready probably within a week, at most 2 weeks. So I'll make sure you all get that, and you're free to distribute that as you see fit. And so I'm not sure whether they're prepared to reveal their names, which is why I've just said 3 biologists and a theologian. I don't know how that's going to play out. But what was interesting about the BioLogos team is we did make significant progress in reconciling our differences. One of the things I thought was very encouraging is that the BioLogos team, at least the 3 scientists on the team, were adamant in denying fully gifted creationism, the kind of theistic evolution that you get from Howard Van Til, which basically states God supernaturally intervened in creation only at one time, when he created the universe. After that, he allowed what he set up to play out in the direction that he intended in the beginning. And the BioLogos team says, of course we believe that God intervened supernaturally when he created the universe, but we don't think God's interventions are limited to just the creation of the universe. However, their definition of intervention clearly is different from our intervention. They would say that God supernaturally intervenes, but not necessarily in a manner that would be easily unmistakable to the human investigator. Now, that's a little bit disturbing in the idea. It sounds like God intervenes, but in a way that you could never find that out. But they were quick to say, no, that's not what we mean. And they flatly denied quantum theology. Quantum theology is this idea that God does supernaturally intervene after the cosmic creation event, but he hides his interventions under the Heisenberg uncertainty principle. And they agreed with us that that simply won't fly. The Heisenberg uncertainty isn't big enough to hide everything that God would need to do. But they were clear in saying, we don't think God supernaturally intervenes in unmistakable ways like you people do at Reasons to Believe. However, they did reveal at least one clear exception. So they believe that God strongly intervened, because you know that what their point was, you guys at Reasons to believe in strong intervention. We don't believe that God intervenes to that degree. You could call it weak intervention, although they didn't use that term. But they do agree that God strongly intervened at least once after the cosmic creation event. Now, I thought they were going to say the origin of life, but they didn't. They said, with the origin of life, we do agree there are no naturalistic answers now. But clearly they're leaving the door open that a naturalistic answer could come. Whereas we're at the position that given the degree that naturalism has failed to come up with any conceivable mechanisms, that it must be a supernatural event. They're not prepared to go that far, at least not yet. But they might in the future. But where they do clearly believe in a strong intervention is when it comes to Homo sapiens. Now, Homo sapiens is not what we are. We are Homo sapiens sapiens. Homo sapiens are not human. They're tropical Neanderthal types. They lived 80,000 to 170,000 years ago. They agree with us on all this stuff, that Homo sapiens are not human. But they agree that they do claim there's a point where Homo sapiens became Homo divinus. In other words, God took one or several or a large group of these Homo sapiens and transformed them by injecting into them a spirit that made them Homo divinus. But they were clear they're still working out the model on that. And that's another thing that we noticed from them is that they were very positive and complimenting us on developing a full-orbed, well-defined, and consistent creation model. And they said, they're also quite frank in saying that they lacked such a model. On the other hand, they said, you know, don't be surprised. You guys have been working on this for 30 years. We've only been doing this for a few years. And it says, you know, our goal is to develop such a model, but we're not there yet. And so that made it a little bit more difficult to try to dialogue because we didn't really know where they stood in a number of issues. They said, well, we're not sure either. In fact, they pointed out that amongst the four of them, they probably held different perspectives, but they weren't even sure if they did hold different perspectives. They said, you know, you need to give us some time, just like people gave you time. But they do possess a fairly well worked out and consistent theological model. And if I had to say one thing in summary, is that we were a lot closer scientifically than we thought we would be. Because we kind of walked into the meeting thinking there'd be significant scientific differences, and we were pleasantly surprised that the differences, although present, are not nearly as great as what we had presumed. But also we had presumed that all of us would be on the same page theologically. And it was a shock to them and a shock to us that we're far apart on the theology. So in terms of future dialogues, at least we're going to be promoting the idea we need to address the theology. That's much more important to address than the science. Yes.
Yeah, where do they put the recent discovery that they made? Artificus in Africa, where it goes back to 4 million years or something like that. Where do they
differ from us? They believe in common descent. So they believe that there is a chain of natural descent that runs through the whole line of the bipedal primates up into human beings. Now, where they would part from that common descent argument is saying at some point God supernaturally intervened and made one of these bipedal primate individuals or groups spiritual in nature. So they do agree with us that human beings are distinct from all other life and that we're the only species that is spiritual in nature. So there's no disagreement there.
They have no faith for that, right?
Well, that's different. I mean, from our perspective, we can pinpoint a date and we can pinpoint exactly how God intervened, that it was a single individual, a geographical location. And from their perspective, they said, we haven't got any of that worked out. So that's all kind of open from their perspective. So, and again, they haven't been at this as long as we have. Yes?
Help me understand the general nature of the theological difference.
That's where I'm going to go next. Okay? Now, when I go there, big disclaimer, I'm not convinced that the three biologists we were dialoguing with would agree with this theological perspective. But they recently hired a theologian to kind of head up their biblical studies program. And I do know that at least a couple of the biologists endorse at least portions of this. But one of the things I brought up was this book, The Lost World of Genesis 1, because I heard that some of them thought this is a good book. And so we kind of got into that, and that's kind of when their theologian jumped in. This is a book by John Walton, where he argues that Genesis really does not have scientific content or creation content. The book is really dealing with Near Eastern myths, and he calls it the Lost World of Genesis 1 because he claims that previous generations of theologians have not understood the meaning of Genesis 1, because only in the last couple of decades have archaeological discoveries really unearthed the full breadth of the myth that existed, creation myth that existed in the ancient world. And so he's arguing for the first time we finally understand what Genesis 1 is communicating. Now, to me, that's disturbing because I believe God inspired the Bible to communicate to all generations of humanity, not just generations that have been alive in the last 10 or 15 years. But in listening to the theological, because that's how we broke up this dialogue. Half of it was devoted to science, half of it was devoted to theology. And I mean, like all of us on our side were on the presumption, well, surely we agree on the theology. But we discovered we're miles apart on the theology. And I learned something I wasn't really appreciative of, is the impact that these two new theological paradigms have. So I'm going to introduce to you some theological terms. I think the reason why I'm doing this, and this may have nothing to do with our dialogue, I think it goes beyond our dialogue, and this is a movement, because I did some research on this and I came home from the Washington, D.C. area. Went on the web, read a lot of books, and what I discovered is there's two brand new theological developments that are really having a major impact on our leading seminaries, not only in the United States, but around the world. And so the theologian that we heard from basically was promoting these two new paradigms, incarnational inspiration and something called post-conservative evangelical theology. Now, I'm going to describe both of these. The theologians certainly endorse both of these. As I said, I'm not convinced that that's true of the scientists. So, again, I don't want you quoting this as something that is a BioLogos party line. But it is something that that was brought up at the meeting. What is this incarnational inspiration? Well, it's based on the belief that the Bible is just like the person of Jesus Christ. Jesus is human and divine. So they're arguing that biblical inspiration has two components, human and divine. Now, I would personally agree with that, just like I would agree that Jesus is fully human and fully divine. However, incarnational inspiration theologians bring up this doctrine with the belief that God allows the weakness and contradictions of the human element to be expressed. So it's a little bit different from the incarnation of Jesus, where Jesus humbles himself, becomes a man, lives amongst us here on earth, but retains his full deity. This incarnational inspiration is different in that it's arguing that the full deity of biblical inspiration is not represented. God plays a role, but God plays a subservient role. In other words, they would argue that it was God's intent to allow the weakness of the human author of the Bible to be expressed. So God basically pulls himself back in order that the weakness and the contradictions of the human element would be fully expressed. Now, where is this all coming from? It's coming from the belief by many theologians that it's impossible to integrate the 66 books of the Bible. And so let me just take this a little bit further in terms of what this post-conservative evangelical theology is all about. It begins with a statement that both liberal and conservative theology must be replaced by a new paradigm. And so the leaders of this movement are saying the liberals are wrong, the conservatives are wrong, we need something brand new. And the brand new part they're promoting is this idea that biblical texts must be studied in isolation to discern their intended meaning. And this is based on the idea that God kind of pulls himself back and allows the culture, the milieu of the human author to be completely expressed, and that's how they deal with what they think are contradictions in the Bible. And so they said, you know, God allows the contradictions to exist in the Bible because God has got a bigger point. He wants the human interpreter to understand the context of the human author. And that's basically what's going on in this book, but it's more strongly expressed in this post-conservative evangelical theology. Now, that gave me an understanding because I spoke first on the theology. And my message was, you know, this is something I think we can all agree on, namely that science and theology can be fully integrated, the 66 books of the Bible can be fully integrated, all the scientific disciplines can be fully integrated. But I was looking at my audience on the other side and realizing I was really making them very disturbed. And I thought, you know, I thought this would be something that everybody would agree on. We can use this as a foundation for dialogue. Instead, I got the opposite reaction. In fact, what Fuzz and Ken said, you know, they were basically okay with what we said, but they really didn't like what you had to say. So I was naive. I didn't know what I was walking into. But it's because they believe this, that texts must be studied in isolation. So when I was saying that the Bible is true from cover to cover. What we see in the scientific disciplines, the record of nature is utterly trustworthy and reliable. Well, they don't believe that. Well, the scientists probably believe that, but the theologian that was there was saying, no, as far as the books of the Bible are concerned, they are not literal and consistent in what they're trying to communicate. So I will put up a hornet's nest with that one, without even intending to. But they would also argue that all attempts to articulate the nature of Scripture are open to examination. In other words, there's nothing in terms of reading this book that we can all agree on is actually what it says. What they're actually saying is this: any doctrine of Scripture must be provisional. So nothing is so clearly revealed we can say for certain that's what the Bible is saying. And what I discovered when I came back home is that the proponents of post-conservative evangelical theology reject the creeds of the church. They reject the creeds because the creeds are saying we can go through the Bible and pick up the elements that for certain we know it's saying. So, I mean, most of us have grown up in some, like you've got the Apostles' Creed, you've got things, and what they're really upset at the Westminster Confession, the Belgic Confession, and the Heidelberg Confession. They said, those have got to go because there's nothing in the Bible that is actually hard and fast. All of it is provisional. I'm running out of time. Let me just finish up and say that the heart of all this is the belief that the Holy Spirit is not the primary author of Scripture. The Spirit merely illuminates the apostles' consciousness, and that apostolic interpretation holds no substantial priority over our own. In other words, we have no advantage over the apostles, which means that people in the 21st century can read the Bible and come up with an interpretation that contradicts what the apostles thought the Bible was saying. And so they use that as a means to reject what the apostles were saying about the Old Testament in particular. Well, I'm sharing all this with you, not that I think this is really has that much to do with our dialogue, but this is bigger than the dialogue. This is something that's taking over many of the leading seminaries, including the conservative seminaries in our country. And I thought it's something that you need to be aware of. I think it's a much bigger issue than I've been giving it credit for in the past. But also makes the point that I think we need to be a little more pointed in dealing with the church, that the Bible really can be faithfully integrated. Evidently, this all stems from a perceived impossibility of looking at the 66 books of the Bible as a self-consistent whole. And it's something I've noticed in seminaries, too. 100 years ago, seminaries had really strong systematic theology departments. That's almost missing today in the seminary landscape. And so there's a real need to get back to that emphasis on systematic theology. And one reason I kind of now understand why you don't see many systematic theologians in seminary campuses, because they believe that it can't be integrated. And therefore, they're kind of going back to this idea, you have to look at books in isolation, and you have to be willing to tolerate contradictions. Well, at least that's not my theology. It's not the way I've ever done science. Maybe this is an opportunity to do for scientists to have an influence on theologians, because even the atheist scientists I know believe that biology, physics, and chemistry fit together in some consistent way. We may disagree in the interpretation, but none of us disagree on the integration. But evidently in theology, there are people there, in fact, what may even be a majority now, that would disavow that. I'm actually 5 minutes over, so tell you what, I'll take your question now, and anyone else has got a question, come up to me afterwards. And we can pick up this discussion next week if you like. Yes?
It's getting pretty complex again. In all these theologians' meetings and interpretations of the Bible now, have the church ever, theologians ever included in this, or is just all this Protestant stuff?
Oh, no. This is bigger than Protestantism, definitely. So, anyway, let me bow for prayer. Father in heaven, Lord, I pray that you'd help us to really see the full scope of the challenges we're facing today in terms of theological discussion and debate. And Lord, help us to be better equipped to meet these challenges, but also to take advantage of them as opportunities, Lord, to present truth in such a way that people can receive it, and also not just receive your truth, but your love and your life as well. So, Lord, help us to be better equipped in being able to give reasons for our faith with gentleness, respect, and a clear conscience. In Jesus' name, amen.
Kind of version of the Jesus seminar today.
They are related to open theism. So,
but I just, you know how they take.